Sally Schneider of New York City is the author of the award-winning book, A New Way to Cook, and writes a syndicated newspaper column by that same name. She is a frequent contributor to National Public Radio's The Splendid Table and to numerous national magazines. I first became aware of Sally's work, about which she will speak today, reading an article of hers in Sever that really entranced me. And I ran into her at the Greenbrier at a conference, back in February, and hounded her, asking her, pleading her to come and share what she knows about this community in West Virginia. And I'm very pleased that she assented. Here comes Sally.
I would have been a fool not to come. The first house you see when you come into Helvetia, West Virginia, from the Mill Creek Road, is a log cabin with a sign over the door that says, Zeitungsraum ist alles. Time and space is all. I'd been coming down to this town for 14 years before I met the woman who built the cabin and hung the amazing sign and entered the life of that town deep in the Appalachian Mountains. Over 30 years ago, I made my first trip there with a bunch of college friends, led by a wild West Virginia boy I hardly knew, in pursuit of the wild leeks called ramps, or rather, the ramps were the excuse to run wild down the glorious Kingwood Pike out of Morgantown to the roadhouse on the Mason-Dixon line called the Lulu Bell Inn and admire the pink neon Lulu Bell emblazoned across the starry sky, or to sit in awed hungover silence in the rough-hewn pews of the Blue Rock Baptist Church. I was not a cook then and never imagined that a drunken lark to the Helvetia ramp supper would be the catalyst for 30 years of returns to finding some roots that had nothing to do with my own. In this unassuming town, settled by Swiss and German immigrants in 1869, I witnessed a piece of Appalachia, I'm going to go back and forth, as they do in Helvetia, that defied the usual stereotypes and told of a culture of breathtaking beauty and originality. The people of Helvetia captured my heart with their generosity and spirit and have taught me more about the real meaning of food and of the different kinds of hungers and the way those hungers can be fed than anyone else in my life. From my first breakfast of thick-sliced homemade toasted bread and tomato jam in the town's only inn, to the butter and cheese made by three old sisters on a remote mountain farm, I have encountered a world where food is a language, both welcoming the visitor and eloquently expressing the local culture. So much in Helvetia revolves around food. Its cultivation and preparation still draw family and friends together, and it is a way that people who don't have much to give to each other can. Food in Helvetia is generally simple fare, southern farm cooking with strong Swiss roots. From the south come cornbread, smoky ham, beans, greens, and lard-crusted pies. From Switzerland come the sweet and sour flavors of sauerbraten and sauerkraut, onion pie, dumplings, and spice cookies. For years, there seemed to be a great cook in every house. Margaret Kerner, her white hair in neat braids, frying donuts barefoot in her spotless kitchen. Bernadine Wooten, round and comforting in a flowered dress, plying me with a raspberry cobbler still warm in its iron skillet. I've come away from people's houses with tomatoes and beans from the garden, slices of pie, homemade wine, wedges of cheese, mason jars of ramps, venison, and peaches. Even perfect strangers give away food as a kind of hello. Lucky Farr's shy wife didn't say a word to me when we met, but went over and picked up a stick and whacked off plums, which she filled my pockets with, a shy woman's way of saying hello. At first glance, Helvetia, nestled in a lush valley near the the state's eastern panhandle in Randolph County appears to be a quiet, private place. You can drive through in less than a minute. Community hall, restaurant, store that doubles as a post office, church. Its population of about 120 people mostly live on farms around the town. For the first years coming to the Ramp Supper, an all-you-can-eat feed put on by the Farm Women's Association, I never stayed in Helvetia and never thought there was any reason to stay. Rather, my friends and I would drive across the mountains to stay in a seedy motel with a sign that boasted colored TV. Then one year, I heard there was an inn in Helvetia, which I never knew because it had no sign, and I stayed after my friends had left. I stayed at the Beekeeper Inn, an old house at the confluence of two forks of the Buckhannon River, and got to know Eleanor Mayhew, who owns it. Eleanor is now close to 90, but looks 60. She was probably in her 70s, late 60s when I met her. She grew up in Helvetia and left to travel the world, and came back pursuing her memory of it. She once told me, "Even as a young girl, I saw how beautiful it is, and I wanted it always to exist." She has really been a force in the town, a kind of one-woman historical society, its protector, an impetus for the refurbishment of houses, the planting of gardens and public spaces, the placing of Helvetia in the National Register of Public Places. Because, like many Appalachian towns, it was languishing, in part because of the state's poor economy and because of the encroachment of media and urban cultures and so on, which we all know about. There's so much to tell, I've got to have notes to keep me online or I'll go on forever and you'll have to get out the hook and pull me off. The first weekend there, Eleanor told me stories of the early families with names like Merkley, Bettler, Ish, Detweiler, and Zumbach, many driven by crop failures in their native barn, also enticed by unscrupulous land agents. It's another current that is not often spoken about. But they came and carved out a thriving town in this area that happens to look like Switzerland. There's a lot of contention about that's what really motivated them. But they named it Helvetia, which is the Latin Appalachian for Switzerland. I've often roamed the area with an Appalachian native named Rogers McAvoy, who was a professor of psychology at Morgantown at the University of West Virginia, and who was a longtime Helvetia homeowner. He and I would spend hours driving in his Jeep throughout the mountains, stopping to talk to people on porches, sitting on porches, or that we met walking along the road, or that we'd meet in bars. And Rogers had a way of kind of sidling up to people, or I should say he would stop and just wait. And what he was doing was showing me a way of talking and beginning a conversation, which was very different from my New York way of, "Hey, how you doing? What are you doing? What are you cooking? What do you got to eat?" You know, like that. He also has been a guide and resource, tracing convoluted lineages of the families and the histories and the mores of this very complex community, part industrious Swiss, part American settler. Helvetia really is a culture that exists within the Appalachian culture, incorporating some of it, maintaining separateness from it in a highly original way. Rural mountain living fostered fierce independence and self-sufficiency and a strong sense of community and family, which is really what drew me there. Rogers used to say to me that to the rest of America, Appalachia was like another civilization. I have to agree, but for none of the derogatory reasons that people say that. To me, going to Helvetia, which is really all I can speak about, was like going to Italy or France. The culture was so distinct and so unique, and it was so beautifully and directly expressed by the food that I was mesmerized by it. and hard-pressed to keep up with all the things that would happen in a day when I would visit there, and I'd go for several weeks at a time. So the stories are going to tell you are completely subjective, and they're the stories and the things that happened, and they're my oral history as a New Yorker of this beautiful town. Irene Hartford and Mary Hicks epitomize what I love most about Helvetia and where I have learned the most. When I met them, the two sisters were in their 70s. They were half Swiss and half Irish, reflecting the integration of other settlers. They were born McNeil on a neighboring farm, then moved to the big house in town where Mary lived and Irene visited. She lived in the cabin across the way and was the one that put up that amazing sign. So the first weekend I stayed in Helvetia, after 14 years of driving into town kind of half drunk and looking at that sign and wondering what the hell it meant and who did it because it was so completely cosmic, I decided to walk down the road and take another look at it. Irene, it turns out, was standing in the yard across the way. "Hi," she said. "Want a cup of coffee?" "I'd love it," I said as I followed her in the house. "Do you know who built that cabin across the way?" "Yeah, I did. They said it'd be easy, and it wasn't. Period." I sit down at the kitchen table, an astonishing chaos of supermarket coupons, ripening tomatoes, shopping lists, jars of pickles, seedlings in paper cups, a glass of mismatched spoons for coffee. Irene looked at me. "What you need is a cheese and tomato sandwich," she said, slicing off a slab of homemade bread. And she built the sandwich and handed it to me on the side of a chef's knife, like this, which I took. "That's Bali cheese," she said, "made on a farm above Pickens." That afternoon, I put away the sandwich, several cups of coffee, a piece of pie, some of her strawberry rhubarb jam, straight out of the jar, and a bunch of pfeffernuss, the jaw-breaking spice cookies that you can only eat if you soften them in coffee. So it began. I would sit at her kitchen table, one of my favorite places on earth, for many years after, as Irene and her sister Mary told me tales of their life in Helvetia, embellishing and correcting each other's stories. Memories and recipes seemed to intertwine, as one sparking the other. The recipe for buckwheat dumplings that they hated as girls led to a story of when Irene ate so many dumplings stuffed with ham with the men at threshing time she thought she was going to burst, which leads to a discussion of the many kinds of sausages her mother used to make, like the one that had sauerkraut and the forcemeat, which would somehow lead to the story of the DeGarmos, a poor Italian family whose kids Irene taught in the one-room schoolhouse. And when she realized they hardly had anything to eat in the lunches they brought every day, she engineered a way to get food donated and made group meals served on plates made by Mrs. DeGarmo, who had hammered them out of pot lids. Went on and on. The apples Mary was preparing reminded them of the cold cellar built by a Swiss that was so perfectly designed it would keep butter sweet and hard as a rock and never smelled of mildew. At that kitchen table, I tasted knepfli, buckwheat dumplings dressed with onions fried in bacon fat, and heard about potato dumplings, dumplings flavored with horseradish known as klossli, dumplings plumped in elderberry soup, and on and on. I learned about not-quite-ripe blackberry pie, rosettes, the deep-fried dough that were sprinkled with sugar, and the best method for making dill pickles. Irene made a study of pickles. Everything in Irene and Mary's kitchen seemed to draw me further into their world. Take the salted trout. Mary used to bury fresh trout in a bucket full of salt to preserve them the way her mother did. The trout were then soaked for days, rolled in cornmeal, and fried crisp in bacon fat. Their bones would be so tender you could just chew them up. From hearing that simple preparation described, I could almost conjure up the kitchen where Mary and her mother prepared huge meals for family and friends and laborers. I gained an inkling of the ways industrious people preserve their food with no refrigeration. Mary was always one of the best cooks in town. She cooked, like many, by feel and by eye. She knows innately what works and what doesn't, and when I ask her for quantities in a recipe, she'd look at me like I was nuts, then think hard and say, "Well, you just take whatever you have and go from there." A logical approach for a cook accustomed to making do with whatever is on hand. If you don't have it, you don't need it, is a philosophical principle in Helvetia, where stores are many miles away on winding mountain roads. Often Mary would awake to find a bushel of somebody's surplus something, cucumbers or ramps or peaches, that they'd left without telling her on her back porch, knowing that she wouldn't be able to bear to let them go away to waste, and would can them and then feed them to everybody who came through. Visitors would always find something good to eat in that kitchen, as in most of the houses that I visited. "Are you hungry?" Irene would ask. "We've hardly a thing to eat," Mary would say, shaking her head and pulling out a ham or delicious beans cooked with home-raised pork or some yeast rolls hot out of the oven. I found that their cooking pretty accurately reflected the cooking in other kitchens in Helvetia, which I began to make my rounds to over the years. Some form of pig ran through much of it, whether stewed pork next, Mary used to serve in a bowl with cornbread, or the lard they rendered for pie crust. In many rural communities, pork, particularly smoked pork, is the linchpin of cooking there. It's economical. Every bit can be used. You can feed the whey from cheese making, a lot of which was done there, and you'd end up with some delicious pork. I had completely extraordinary mincemeat pie one Sunday at Bunch Detweiler's, who'd laid out a spread for the family. The mincemeat was rich, sweet, and mellow with an amazing depth of flavor. I found out it had been made with a hog's head by our Uncle Norman. It was one of the last jars of his last batch that he had canned before he died. It was always made at hog butchering time from a recipe that started, "Take out the eyes, brains, and teeth of a hog's head, throw away." The remainder was boiled in water in a big kettle outdoors, and then the meat was pulled off the bone and mixed with apples and spices and wine and sugar and whatever else they wanted to put into it. And Norman recommended saving the water for soup. If you seasoned it with garlic and canned it, it would be perfectly delicious in the winter if you added some beans or cabbage or whatever. Nothing was ever wasted. Dairy, predominantly cow's milk, figured heavily into Helvetia's cuisine. For years, the town was famous for its cheese, an alpine style similar to Appenzeller. And the most famous of Helvetia's cheesemakers was the Bali sisters, whose cheese Irene slapped on my sandwich. The Bali girls, as they are known throughout Helvetia, were three industrious sisters. When I met them, I'd say they were in their mid to late 70s. They lived on and worked the remote 215-acre farm on which they were born. It nestled into a crest of a hill above Pickens on a remote road. They had no phone but communicated with neighbors by CB radio. They spoke still with strong Swiss-German accents and were unbelievably industrious, even at that age, raising pigs, tending cows and chickens. Their eggs were almost double the size of normal ones, making quilts all winter long, picking hickory nuts, growing all manner of vegetables in their garden, canning them. Their cellar was a dazzling array of home canned foods. They also sold their butter, which they molded into beautiful round blocks and salted so heavily you had to get used to it at first. And then after a while, the flavor and creaminess would burst forth. I used to eat that butter shaved cold onto hot cornbread, and it was one of the best things on earth. One day I went up to watch them make the cheese. I had been there many times to buy it. And they said, okay, come early in the morning and you can see what we do. Actually, they didn't say that much. They just kind of shrugged when I said I wanted to do it. There they were, dressed in tattered men's clothes, herding the 5 cows into the barn, which they then milked by hand. They hauled the heavy milk pails uphill to the house and heated it on a wood-fired stove. The cheese making then was this long process of taking the cans on and off the stove, which they did themselves. Then they drained the curds and poured them into molds. Then after that, they'd have to rub them with salt and wash them a couple of times a week for the first 2 weeks, and then age them for 5 weeks. Once Frida said, "We earn our money," after they had done a batch of cheese, and indeed they did. It not only took many hours to make a block of cheese, but it took 8 gallons of milk to yield 5 pounds, which they sold for $2.50 a pound. Every family in Helvetia used to make cheese. Now only about 2 do. One of them went to Switzerland to learn new ways. The others were making it in the traditional way, although each batch is different and each person's cheese is different because it's the real thing. It is though one only has to scratch the surface in Helvetia and there's a memory of something that happened, a piece of life being lived. Rogers and I once drove Irene and Mary back up to their old home place where there were no buildings standing. But as we walked the land, one or the other of them would say, "Now here's where the smokehouse was," or "Here's where Papa grew tobacco," or "Here's where we snuck through the fence." As we stood on a grassy knoll with the stones of the hearth barely visible, they painted a picture of their childhood in the early 1900s with such vivid detail we could almost see it for ourselves. Irene is a little girl eating the potato dumplings with the men at threshing time, or Mary and her mother canning huge quantities of food or making cornbread or tatting or quilting, keeping the place going in all the ways that were mentioned earlier. Standing over the spot where the cold cellar was, they rattled off the larder it held. Beef, pork, ham, chicken, cabbage, potatoes, onion, on and on and on, sour cream, buttermilk, crocks of kraut and piccalilli, on and on. One day I went up to Margie Detweiler's, the wife of Norman, the mincemeat maker, to talk about quilts and ended up hearing about all the greens her family used to collect. Again, you heard the list earlier, which included wild mustard, poke, nettle, sheep sorrel, lamb's tongue. That would then lead to the herbs that they collected for medicines and for healing, which would then take us over to her daughter Nancy's house to taste the violet jelly she made every spring. Few people gather greens anymore in Helvetia. Probably the most prominent one, and the one that's really celebrated, is the ramp, which is, as you probably know, the wild leek that is the first green thing to appear in springtime. And Helvetia is one of the many ramp suppers that goes on throughout the state in community halls and Elks clubs and churches and so on. Helvetia is favored over many, however, because of the quality of the food and also the feeling in the place. Going to their ramp supper is like being in some big extended family. The supper, ham, soup, beans, greens, cornbread, slaw, applesauce, what have I forgotten, cooked ramps, raw ramps, served family style at long tables as the kids run back and forth to replenish the dishes. And you're at this table with people eating exactly the combinations on the fork they love and telling you why they love them, and there's nothing better than that. Ramps are the source of huge passions around there still. I have tons of recipes I've collected or that people have offered in bars, and actually one guy just invited me in his house after he dug a mess and that he was taking to his mother in a nursing home. In the Rebel Lounge in Bealington, I watched an old man come in and put a cigar box full of perfectly trimmed ramps on the bar, order two slices of bread and a beer, make a sandwich, and eat it in complete silence in a kind of meditative way. The Helvetius Ramp Supper really exemplifies the community effort there. It's done to raise money for the Farm Women's Association to help with the community hall renovations or whatever. It is the result of weeks of planning and the entire community's efforts. The most arduous work is cleaning 60 bushels of ramps, which are still clumped with dirt, having been dug by a couple of families who keep their place secret. Then all of Helvetia pitches in. They straddle the benches in the community hall for hours at a time with little paring knives, talking, gossiping, cleaning the ramps, paring potatoes, doing whatever is necessary. The ramps are boiled out in a big kettle that's then two guys watching over it. It's stirred with a pitchfork, drained on oilcloth punched with holes, left to cool, and then frozen as they gather them for the supper. And that day they'll fry them up with bacon fat that they've rendered out of 60 pounds of bacon, which I did once with a woman named Millie. I smelled like a smokehouse for days after that. And I got a glimpse of the amount of effort it takes to pull off like something like this. The quantity of food would involve 350 pounds of ham, 60 pounds of beans, 75 pounds of cornmeal. That kind of quantity. So after the supper, after people have been fed, after they've waited online often for 2 or 3 hours at a time, tortured by the smells coming out of the hall, they would wander around the town or sip bourbon or just hang out until the square dance started. A for real square dance. We don't think that they exist anymore, but in Helvetia, every supper is followed by a dance. You'd hear the sound of violins reverberating against the hillsides, and in the hall, grandmothers were dancing with grandkids and city folk with country folk, and it would go on for hours. An amazing thing. Every year, as their numbers decline, members of the Farm Women's Association vote whether or not to continue the supper. With less and less people to help, it is backbreaking work. And you can see the valiant effort they're making to pull it off each year, because one of the things that's happening is the older people are disappearing. The ramps are only one of many celebrations that they have to make this decision about. There's the chicken supper, there's Fasnacht, which is a kind of amazing ritualized killing of Old Man Winter, a kind of pre-Lenten festival where people dress up in papier-mâché masks and parade around and eat wonderful fried dough. But the Helvetia Fair is probably the celebration where the town really shows their Swiss roots and their immense pride in it. It is kind of like a small county fair with ribbons given for the best canned goods or baked goods or crafts project. But then they have a parade of homemade floats, often driven by tractors and that sort of thing, where they display the Swiss way of farming in the Swiss culture. They dress in Swiss clothes, there's Swiss folk dancing, there's yodeling, things like that. What's quite amazing, though, is that even there you see where Swiss has married with Appalachian. In the folk dancing, the music behind it is fiddle music that has a distinctly kind of American old-timey lilt that's really beautiful. There are many things that bring me back to Helvetia year after year. I could go on and on about the smells alone of apple blossoms and ramps in the spring and wood smoke in the winter. Even the houses seem to smell of the woods and of that smoke. There's my friend Kay, who hunts bear and wild turkey and teaches me about those ways. There's the moonshine that tasted faintly of raspberries, the dandelion wine Eleanor taught me to make that had stayed in the cellar so long forgotten that it ended up tasting like a French sauterne. But most of all, there were moments and unexpected meetings that have become like jewels in my memory. One August evening, Rogers and I were sitting on his porch when we heard this very odd music coming down the road from the restaurant, and we followed it down, a lazy, old-fashioned, honking oompa music with a clarinet doing melody and many missed notes and slow parts due to uncertain sight reading. We walked over. Four bald men in shirt sleeves were playing brass horns on the porch, tuba, clarinets, trombone. Eleanor and her old friend Louise were dancing a languid waltz in the road. Her daughter's children, were dancing in the road, kind of quietly. A moon rose, the mist lay close over the tops of the trees of the mountains. Cool night was descending, and I felt like I was in some kind of Fellini movie. It had that quality of memory and sweetness and of a language almost, in a way of life of another time. But here I was in Appalachia, in America. There is something else about Helvetia, too, and that is its originality and its defiance of tradition. This is something that has been brought up a little bit earlier. It was a kind of sense of inconsistencies or eccentricities, like the huge jar of coffee creamer that always sat on Irene and Mary's table, or the package of supermarket cookies that lay strewn around next to a gallon of homemade cookies. Or one night I would have an incredible skillet full of bread, like a cornbread, but made with graham flour, like their mother used to make. And the next night Irene would pull out some dough-conditioned instant loaf from the oven, split it, and spread it with this incredible Bali butter and these beautiful preserves. So I asked her about why she did this, why when they had these incredible foods that they made, they bought these other ones and these supermarket ones, and she totally kind of avoided the issue. She said, I know what you're talking about. On a road trip to California, I could only eat toast, and decried the American diet and modernism. But there was no real answer to that, and why should there be? Another time, Rogers and I were up at the Bollies, who had just made this incredible fresh cottage cheese and were mixing cream into it, and I was just imagining eating the whole thing, when Frida opens a can of canned pineapple and dumps it on top. And she just looked and said, we like it that way. That's all there is to it. It's as simple as that. It didn't mean anything. They ate mostly homemade stuff, no big deal about that, and they filled in with other stuff that made sense in their lives. For me, it was their own peculiar and particular balance of things that I loved that kind of flew in the face of an almost puritanical purity I can have, or a desire for consistency, or a feeling that there should, if you make this, then you should make that. And that becomes like a weight. But the coffee creamer and the store-bought cookies were also a sign, I realize now, and that is of change, of modern life, if you will, working its way in. And I say that because for years I had the feeling that this town had been protected, in part by the mountains, meaning that if you wanted to go, you had to want to go there to get there. People just didn't amble in. And before satellite dishes and so on, media just didn't come in and at you. And because of that, there was, I think it was protected in a way. Used to be that every quilt was made out of cotton scraps. The last years that I was going up to Bali's, they would make these quilt kits with polyester, which I found amazing. But they explained, I asked about it. Not like, what are you doing, but I see you've switched fabrics, and it's easier. It's easier for us to do this. They still had the experience of quilting with each other in the winter, and the quilts were easier to take care of. Rogers and I used to visit a place near Helvetia called Silica, where all there was a rusty old school bus with a huge hearth built onto it. And it was said that a hermit had lived there and built the hearth. I loved it because it was a symbol of me, of what I saw all over the place, of a kind of self-sufficiency and an originality of thinking. What was also very touching about going there, though, was I had seen pictures of Silica at the turn of the century, and it had been a thriving town. There was a glass factory, a railroad, houses, and it was gone, disappeared. There was no trace, like Irene and Mary's farm, like life was being lived all over America that there is no trace of anymore. So what I've been doing down there is kind of bearing witness, I felt, to this extraordinary culture, and all the while I was aware of its evanescence, as though it were fading into a mist. I've become like one of the old people whose table I've sat at, because I go and I remember people and places and things and food and ways that no longer exist. The last trip back, I heard many Helvetians during the fair mentioning the dwindling numbers, their concerns about the future, meaning they were concerned about how to continue the traditions that they had carried on that far, which took so much work, and which was in part about memory, and the memory was in part being lost when the older people died. There's a Helvetia Restoration Association, which is hard at work on an archive. There's talk of creating a cheese-making business or a jam-making business. But I think there's a cookbook that the Farm Women's Association just produced, and I saw the first copy, and I think it exemplifies some of what's happened. The first page is a Mexican recipe. Then you go on to focaccia and all this other stuff, and buried within it are Mary's custard pies, rhubarb custard pie, for example, or other Swiss dishes. It's very different from the cookbook that that Eleanor put together a few years, well, in the late 60s, that is almost all Swiss cooking or farm cooking. There is a matter that they're struggling with, which is the practical matter of survival. It's partly because of the economics of the place. There's not much going on there. They need business. They need new ways coming in, and yet they don't know how to resolve that in terms of the old traditions. I once asked Eleanor if she'd like it if I wrote about Helvetia, because I was so mixed about it, because I was worried about what would happen if people discovered it, meaning there can be such a strong encroachment. And she said, write about it. We need it. We need people to know about us, because it's very hard to get here, and we need the business, basically. So I go back and I go back, and I found that there is evidence of its past and its spirit still everywhere, in the way the town is, in the way people are cooking, in its archives and photos, in the old houses and farms, and still the food. In her restaurant, Eleanor serves the onion pie called bola flata, which is like a quiche, rusty potatoes, which are grated potatoes fried in butter, sour braten, real Swiss dishes. I am also surprised when I start talking to someone, as started to happen when I was there last, who, as soon as I began to ask a few questions, remembered hams from pig that had fed on chestnuts and could tell me why partridges were no longer hunted in that area, why they disappeared, and what the origins of the name Czar was, which is a town up the road. So it's still there, but it's, I think it is evanescent, and I am a chronically hungry person, deep hunger. I'm looking to be fed on many levels, and I am still in Helvetia. It goes way beyond the food, but food has been the door in, a living metaphor, the simple way the people there have figured to give, comfort, celebrate, express themselves and their history, farms, and heritage. Over many years, these generous people quietly taught me what family is and fed my hunger for one. It is an unlikely adoption, to be sure, a kid from New York to a group of Swiss in Appalachia. Every year I make the long trip from the city to this place that I still find rare and mysterious, and where I've always had the feeling of being home. Thanks.
About them is that they smell absolutely horrible when they're cooking and when you're eating them, but maybe those are just Tennessee rams. But you didn't mention any of that.
I could go on and on about ramps. They're now a big passion for ramps in New York because they're dug in the Catskills. Ramps stink. But the farther south you get, I think the more they have this kind of pungency that gives you that sweat on your skin after you eat them. You either love them or you hate them. There are people in Helvetia who won't let ramps be cooked in their house. And there are other people, like this guy with the cigar box full of ramps. I could tell you story after story of testimonials from strangers about the virtues of ramps.
More. Yes.
Yes. Helvetia. I have a copy of the cookbook Eleanor put together that you all can look at, and you can order it if you want. You can also probably contact her to take a look at the copy of the new one with the Mexican food, but that actually has a lot of treasures in it. I highly recommend visiting the place, particularly during one of the celebrations, which you can find out if you call the inn. I can leave that info. That's right. I forgot about that. There are a couple of websites. I think it's www.swissvillage.com.
Okay, one last. Frank, I saw you in the back.
Well, the problem appears to be that it's very hard to find work. There are young that left, some have come back, and they're trying to figure out industries of their own and new businesses. There's a lot of talk about that to try to create some energy there. Making a living is hard. There is a great deal of nostalgia, I find, for the traditions. And a kind of what I perceive to be a mix about how to carry it on and live as a modern, you know, in this world, make a living and also have the things that you want to have. Again, there is that question of stuff and of opportunity. And so the jury's not out yet because some of the young have been coming back. But for example, the high school, the number of kids has dwindled from 250 down to 50, probably in the last 10 years. There's talk of closing the post office by, you know, the government because there isn't enough. So everybody's buying stamps so that in hoarding them, it's like a drive to keep it open because there was a fight a few years ago to keep the school open because they wanted to bus the kids. Things like this have very much to do with keeping the community intact and giving it a chance to keep living. Thanks a million.